Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for being here. I'm Rick Santorum. I'm a senior fellow here at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and let me welcome you to Ethics and Public Policy and to our forum today. The subject is on Islam and religious liberties, and as I have been traveling around the country giving talks on the issue of the war and the struggle that we're engaged with on college campuses primarily, it's been an enlightening part of the discussion. Obviously, I talk about the importance of religious liberty and the struggle that we're engaged in and the role of religious liberty in dealing with radical Islam. And I've had some of the more interesting discussions, not just in the Q&A, but after the fact, in talking to some of the Muslims that show up at these speeches. In fact, every one of my speeches, I've had rather large Muslim presence at these speeches. And interesting that the public reaction to all of my speeches from the Muslim community is overwhelmingly antagonistic and negative. The private reaction is something very different, which I find rather remarkable. But I want to relate just one story on this topic in particular, and in the issue of religious freedom. I remember it was at Harvard. I spoke, and there was a group of two women and one man who were Muslims who were talking to me afterwards, and they were saying that, you know, what I was saying about Islam was completely wrong, and that the intolerance that I had talked about in my speech was misguided. And I said, well, let's just let me give you an example. Can you answer a question for me? So what about the concept that in Islam you're not allowed to convert? There is no religious freedom. You're not allowed to convert to Christianity if you're a Muslim, and that if you do, that you would be you'd be killed. And the woman immediately just popped up to me and said, well, if I wanted to convert, not that I would, but if I wanted to convert here, I could do it anytime I wanted. That'd be no problem. I said, okay, what if you lived in Saudi Arabia and you wanted to do that? Silence. Young man jumps up and says, that's different. I said, oh, well, why is it different? He said, well, because Islam is the government, and if you convert, you're a traitor. And so these are three folks at Harvard that you would look at and say, these are moderate Muslims. These are people who, you know, these are not jihadis. These are not people who see, you would look at and say, well, here's a problem. But they are, in fact, jihadis, because they adopt that rhetoric, that it is impermissible. There is no religious freedom in the Muslim world. It is in the world outside of Islam. If you're in a country that Islam is not the dominant religion, then you can live by that. But once you're in the world of Islam, it is a different rule. And so that is the issue that we're dealing with today. Can we, in fact, within the world of Islam, tolerate religious freedom? And we have, I'm not supposed to introduce, so I won't. I'm leaving that to Keith. But we have some wonderful speakers here today that will provide tremendous insight into that, and I'm thrilled to have them here with me. But at this point, though, I will turn it over to Keith Pavlicek, who is the executive director of the Program to Protect America's Freedom here at Ethics and Public Policy. Keith?
Welcome. I must say, we put this together on relatively short notice, and I'm absolutely pleased, but also somewhat surprised at the very large turnout on a subject matter that may not have immediate partisan or political relevance in this town. So I think this says something about the interest of the topic. So welcome. Last October, 138 Muslim clerics addressed Pope Benedict XVI and 26 other Christian denominational representatives, along with leaders of Christian churches everywhere, with a letter entitled A Common Word Between Us and You. Today's discussion focuses specifically on that part of the letter related to religious liberty. In the Holy Quran, the Muslim leaders instruct us, God Most High tells Muslims to issue the following call to Christians, and parenthetically, they and to Jews, the people of the scripture. Say, O people of the scripture, come to a common word between us and you, that we shall worship none but God, and that we shall ascribe no partner to him, and that none of us shall take others for lords besides God. And if they turn away, then say, bear witness that we are they who have surrendered unto him. After citing a few authoritative commentaries on the Quran, we are told the passage that none of us shall take others for lords besides God means that none of us should obey in disobedience to what God has commanded, nor glorify them by prostrating to them in the same way as they prostrate to God. In other words, the Muslim leaders comment, they say, that Muslims, Christians, and Jews should be free to each follow what God commanded them, and not to have to prostrate before kings and the like. For God says elsewhere in the Holy Quran, let there be no compulsion in religion. This clearly, they tell us, relates to the second commandment and to the love of the neighbor, of which justice and freedom of religion are a crucial part. So, freedom of religion, we are told, is grounded in the command to love our neighbor, which Muslims share with Christians. What are we to make of this statement? When one thinks of the Sharia law in Islamic nations, there are a few freedoms that do not immediately leap to mind. The free exercise of religion, the free expression of one's religious convictions, the freedom to openly evangelize or, more pejoratively, proselytize, the right to convert to and from other religions, including the right to convert from Islam, and a freedom from legal penalties, such as the death penalty, for leaving Islam. In short, what we typically understand as religious liberty does not go hand in hand with our conception of Sharia law. In fact, we tend to associate the opposite with Sharia law, not religious freedom, but religious persecution, to include legal sanctions against apostasy and blasphemy. So what are we to make of all this? Are these Muslim leaders explicitly or implicitly embracing the free exercise of religion, the right to proselytize, the right to convert from Islam without legal sanction, and rejecting legal prescriptions of apostasy and blasphemy? Is our tendency to relate Sharia law with religious persecution rather than religious freedom merely an expression of our Islamophobia or ill-informed public perceptions related to Danish cartoons or Sudanese teddy bears? Or do we have good reason to be skeptical of such claims? Dr. Patrick Sukdio, is that close? Okay, I'm sorry. Is deeply skeptical about the letter as well as the Christian response authored by Yale Divinity School's Center for Faith and Culture. An international authority on jihadist ideology, he is a senior visiting fellow at the Defense Academy of the UK and visiting fellow at Cranfield University. He has lectured British and NATO and American military officers on radical Islam. He holds a PhD from London University's School of Oriental and African Studies and the DD from Western Seminary in Portland, Oregon for his work on pluralism. He is the author editor of 10 books and numerous essays on these subject areas, including his most recent, which I believe is outside, Global Jihad, the Future in the Face of Militant Islam. He is the international director of the Barnabas Fund and the Institute for the Study of Islam and Christianity. After Dr. Sukdio agreed to speak with us today, I contacted the Yale Divinity School's Center for Faith and Culture to invite them to send a respondent. Given the relatively short notice, I very much appreciate Dr. Andrew Saperstein's presence with us this afternoon. I will introduce Dr. Saperstein following Dr. Sukdio's presentation. Just by way of comment, our plan is to hear from our main presenter for 20 minutes, a 10-minute response. We'll have a little bit of discussion back and forth, and then we're going to open it up to questions and answers from you all. I think we said in the invitation that we're going to go to 1:30, But given the late start, if you need to go by 1:30, perfectly permissible. But I think the question and answers may take us a little beyond that to 1:45. Don't feel free to get up and leave if you need and got other appointments. But I'd like to try to have as much question and answer time as we can. Dr. Sutio.
May I begin by thanking so much the Senator and for the Institute here for holding this seminar and also for inviting me to be a part of it. So thank you so much, Senator, and thank you for the very kind introduction which has just been given. I come at this subject, you could say wearing many hats or from a multifaceted background. I came from a Muslim background, started my Islamic training at the age of 4 and a half, became a Christian, was studying architecture. You could say I'm a convert. Together with my wife, spent 40 years of Christian ministry in evangelism, church planting, Bible teacher, a pastor, amongst other things. An Episcopalian minister. My ordination is the Church of Pakistan, which makes me Episcopalian, Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian, and Old Catholic. So a bit of a person to everybody, with brethren charismatic sympathies. My academic work has been in Islam, and the past 6 years or more, I also function within the security industry and have worked, been deployed both in Iraq and Afghanistan as a military advisor. So I come from that background, but my main work today lies with the Barnabas Fund, which is to assist Christian minorities within the Islamic world. I fully realize that we live at a time of great uncertainty. I remember after 9/11 being called in by a senior British politician to brief him on Islam, and he said this to me. He said, you know, 6 weeks ago, I and most of my colleagues knew absolutely nothing about Islam. Now, we have to be experts, because we have to take the issues of Islam and Muslim communities and what's going on in the world in consideration. And therefore, we have to know, we have to understand. And in that sense, since your tragedy of 9/11, there has been a sea change in terms of thinking, in terms of information, in terms of material out there, which impacts upon all of us. And so I think it is right that we grapple with these issues, not just from the basis of what is before us, but set within a context which is geopolitical, which is military, which is interfaith, which is social cohesion. All of these things now affect us, and therefore we can't separate out so neatly one from the other. What I've done is to prepare a booklet, which you will have received when you came in. And what I wanted to do with my colleagues was to prepare a considered account. Not one which would be reactive, which would be emotional, but rather to say, what are we dealing with? What is the context in which such a letter was written, and what can we infer from it? So what I will be doing very briefly is to summarize that booklet and then to branch out from there. I think history is important because, as we will all know, it's set within the context of Pope Benedict's speech of the 11th of September 2007, which created great stir across the Muslim world as well as within the West. As a response to his speech, some 38 Muslim scholars in October of the 2006, 38 scholars wrote a letter to Pope Benedict effectively correcting what they perceived as several errors in his presentation, in his Regensburg address. May I say, it's just been done, so there are a number of typos. Please do forgive me for those typos. Now, His Holiness decided not to respond, so the Vatican gave no response to that letter, but rather stated that the Pope had been misunderstood by Muslims. So there was an overall response there. On the 13th of October 2007, 138 Muslim scholars, that's 100 more, decided that they would continue the theme of addressing His Holiness the Pope. But they decided that given that it would seem he didn't really respond, that they would go much, much broader and address the world Christian community and say, look, you need to get our position on your agenda. And they took as their theme a common word spoken between us and you, which of course occurs from within the Quran, and I'll touch on the context a little bit later. And it was organized by a well-known institute under royal patronage in Jordan itself. Now, there were two obvious problems relating to the document. One, it totally ignored non-monotheistic religions such as Hinduism, Buddhism, and others. This might imply that Islam's relationship to them is still the same as the ancient polytheists who were given the choice of converting to Islam or being killed. And it is a very real question. Why were they not included? Two, it almost completely ignores Jewish people and Islam's attitudes towards them. And this would seem to fit with contemporary Muslim efforts to drive a wedge between Christians and Jews and form an alliance of Christians and Muslims and Christians against Jews who are increasingly bearing the brunt of a widespread Muslim anti-Semitic discourse. Yale chose to respond, and on the 13th of November 2007, as a response to the Muslim letter, a response was made. And the Christian response was to a common word spoken between us and you. And this letter is now referred to as the Yale Statement. And of course, it has received many, many signatories. And I think it'd be right to say that the majority of them being from an evangelical persuasion. I think the question does need to be asked, why did so many Christian leaders sign the Yale Statement? I think it's right to say they surely did it in good faith and with the best of intentions. I, for one, would cast no aspersions on motives. I think there's a real sense within the Christian community that we must address the issues before us, however hard it is, and I think in good faith many signed. But it's interesting to note the varieties of motives which some have given when they were asked why they signed. Some believed it is the right way to respond with Christian love and charity. Some were motivated by fear of the potential for a global conflict with Islam, or specifically a conflict with Islam affecting the region in which they themselves live. Some were hopeful that this response would open the way for a process of reconciliation between Islam and Christianity. Some took a naively trusting approach, accepting the Muslim letter at face value without any suspicions of hidden agendas. Some were particularly impressed by the wide spectrum of Muslim signatories and by the ironic tone of the letter, and saw it as a unique historical opportunity to mend fences with Islam. Some took a pragmatic view that the developing dialogue would open the way for Christian mission and evangelism in Muslim lands, and for freedom for Muslims to accept Christ and convert to Christianity. Some did not study the document in detail, but rather trusted the advice of others who encouraged them to sign it. Now, as a response to the open letter, the Barnabas Fund put forward an analysis, and some of you may well have seen that, on the 28th of November 2007. By the way, the documents are all in the appendix. And we in the fund try to grapple with the letter. We saw the letter as falling into the Muslim tradition of Dawah, the call to convert and submit to Islam, which in history was often linked to the threat of violent war and conquest should the call be rejected. And I think it's very important to read our statement and particularly set it within the background of other letters, particularly those which it is said Muhammad wrote to the nations of his day who weren't Muslim. The Muslim letter clearly indicates the centrality of the concept of Tawhid, that is, the monolithic unity of God and the finality of the prophethood of Muhammad, as against the central Christian doctrines of the deity of Christ and the Trinity. Jesus is reduced and Islamicized to a mere human prophet subservient to Muhammad. Most of the Quran and Hadith passages quoted included attacks on those who associate others with God. In traditional Orthodox Islamic text, is always interpreted as an attack on Christian corruptions. Thus, what would superficially appear to be an offer of common ground in love of neighbor, of God and one's neighbor, in reality turns out to be little more than a missionary pamphlet extolling Islam and denigrating the very heart of Christianity. It seems likely that the Muslim authors assumed that Muslim readers would understand the veiled intentions, whilst Christian readers not conversant with Muslim traditions would fail to do so. The New Year message, 138 Muslim scholars, and again, note the play, 138, as a sign of gratitude for the generally positive Christian response, the Muslim scholars published a Muslim message of thanks and of Christians and New Year greetings, December 2007. By the way, these circulate in the Daily Telegraph, you know, in the UK and elsewhere. In this message, the original Dawah theme of the letter was repeated, i.e. the centrality of Tawhid's concept of Islam. What's interesting was within this letter of greetings was this very strong statement that God has no associates. It's equivalent for us writing to the Muslims on, say, Eid or their central festival and then putting within it, Muhammad is a false prophet. You know, it would be clearly be unacceptable. And yet the Muslim community felt they could send us greetings on one of our most precious days and include it within it that Jesus was a false prophet, in effect. The Vatican was slow to respond to the Muslim initiative. What is very interesting, though, has been the Vatican response. And you will see this detailed within there. And it's very important to see what his Pope sought to do. Rather than write a letter offering apologies, welcoming, he literally laid out his own agenda and says, look, why don't you come and meet with us? And then he set the agenda. And he set the agenda in terms of human rights and religious liberty. And says, we need to meet. It is essential that we meet together. But let us discuss what is essential, the way in which we treat each other, and what is the status of Jews, Muslims, Christians together, and how we share a common society. They turn this down. And he says, what we want is not to discuss that, but theology and spirituality. To which the Vatican says, hang on, you're not going to have that. You want to meet with us. Then let us address the central issues. So the Vatican actually has led the way in terms of how to meet a letter such as this. Not by apologizing, not by engaging in fulsome praise, but rather to say, let's look at this and see what the important issues are. And as you will see, I outlined two Catholic theologians, both of whom have responded. And you will see in particular the Arab theologian. Now, many others have since responded. What I think I'd like to do very, very quickly, and I've only got a four more minutes, I think, Mr. Chairman, is the analysis of the Yale statement. I think the difficulty that I have with this statement, it doesn't take sufficiently into account truth. And I'm sure we all agree with the threefold statement, speak the truth always, speak the truth in love. I'm sure you agree with me on that. And if we're going to accept the dictum of speaking the truth and speaking the truth always, then we have to hold the Muslims to account for those who signed this common letter. Because the love of God is not central to Islam. And note that in the appendix, by the way, I included the major statement put out by the institute which actually circulated this, Hoffman, who is a German ambassador converted to Islam, who addressed the issues to the love of God. And he says very clearly, it is not central to Islam. So please do read their understanding. Equally, love of neighbor. There is no concept of love of neighbor in Islam. It is based on the Sharia understanding of humanity, of one's relationship firstly to Muslim men, then to Muslim women, then to pagans who were to be killed, Jews and Christians who were to be made dhimmis, second-class citizens. And then what do you do with apostates? They fall into the category of dissidents who were to be killed. Now, 138 Muslims signed this, including two of the key persons of the Al-Azhar. Last weekend, the Al-Azhar issued a new fatwa on conversion. Of those Christians who had converted to Islam or said to have converted to Islam and came back to Christianity, you know what the fatwa says? They are now to undergo the Sharia punishment for apostasy, and I don't know if you know what that is, for reconversion. It's not just killing. It is cutting off the body parts until they die. That is this last weekend. And I want to say to Yale, to everyone, use two of the most members of the most prestigious Islamic institution in the world have shown, quote, their tolerance in saying, we love our neighbors who are Christians. And they've just now passed a fatwa saying that their neighbor, who is a convert to Islam like me, but more specifically, in their case, allegedly converted, reconverted, must now, and by the way, it's normally you're tied up, and then body parts are slowly cut off until you die. Where is truth? At least have the decency to say, we're going to kill him, rather than say, love your neighbor. What kind of love suggests that? I could go into much, much greater detail. So my first point on the Yale, where is truth in all of this? Secondly, my concern with the Yale response is the apology. The apology is linked to the war on terror. The Yale response actually links to two. In the second paragraph, Muslims and Christians have not always shaken hands in friendship. Their relations have sometimes been tense, even characterized by outright hostility. It quotes, taking the log out of your eye, and then it says, we want to begin by acknowledging that in the past, e.g. the Crusades, and in the present, e.g. in excesses of the war on terror. Many Christians have been guilty of sinning against our Muslim neighbors. May I say, do you accept this? That you are guilty and implicit of, quote, the excesses of the war on terror, and you need to hold out and ask the Muslims for an apology. I find that unacceptable. The war on terror, whatever we think of it, is a political matter being pursued by a government. You may not agree with that. But the Muslims have linked it to Christianity, and what has Yale done? It has accepted it and says we are now complicit within the global war on terror, so we apologize to you. And so the Muslim journalists are so pleased that Christians have owned up to what? To Crusades. But where was Islamic Jihad for over 300 years that precipitated a response on behalf of Christian minorities in the Muslim world? Where is the acts of Islamic violence throughout history, including genocide in our day, whether it be Armenians and Sudanese? And if a government chooses to legitimately conduct a war post 9/11, are we now going to apologize? And I find this unacceptable. And this is why it is creating it. And my final point, which I find unacceptable, is the fact that it does not take into account of what Pope Benedict has rightly called for, the social context in which meetings must take place and discussions relating to human rights and religious liberty. Thank you.
Dr. Andrew Saperstein is the Associate Director of the Reconciliation Program at the Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. In this capacity, Dr. Saperstein helps to organize and facilitate programs that promote reconciliation between Muslims and Christians and Muslim nations in the West by drawing on the resources of the Abrahamic faith and the teachings and person of Jesus Christ. Initiatives of the program involve Muslim communities around the world and significant engagement with both Christian and Jewish communities. Dr. Saperstein played a central role in the center's response to the Muslim letter. He received his BA in linguistics from the University of Chicago and went on to study advanced work in linguistics at The Ohio State University, receiving his MA in 1991 and his PhD in 1996. Since that time, he has worked with Afghan refugees in various capacities in Pakistan and Uzbekistan, as well as serving as a consultant to multiple Afghan humanitarian agencies. I once again want to thank you for being able to join us on short notice. Please welcome Dr. Saperstein.
I also want to thank everyone here at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Senator Santorum, Dr. Pavlicek, and others for hosting this event, for extending the invitation to me to attend. Maybe it was late in the day that I got in the invitation, but that's all the less time that I could get nervous about it, right? I tip my hat to The Ohio State University, because that's what they have on their logo, and it has to be a capital T on the. So I also very much want to express my appreciation to Dr. Sukhdeo, obviously a man of very deep and nuanced knowledge of the Islamic textual tradition and Islamic communities around the world, for the devoted advocacy work that he has done on behalf of persecuted Christian communities, for his vocal support of religious freedom worldwide. I also wanted to thank you, particularly Dr. Sukhdeo, for what I thought was a very good characterization of the wide range of signatories to the Yale response. I think you covered pretty much all the bases in regard to that, and I very much appreciated that. My background, just very briefly, I only have 10 minutes, I've used one. I was raised in a completely secular home. My father was a non-practicing Jewish man. Both of his parents were Jewish. My mother was a non-practicing Christian. She said we're Protestants, but we never practiced any faith tradition at all growing up. I had sort of a line in the sand embracing of the Christian faith when I was 19, and have lived a good bit of my adult life in the Muslim world. We lived for several years in Peshawar, Pakistan, which, as many of you know, is really at the epicenter of much of the global conflict involving militant Islam. We lived for about 2.5 years in Quetta, Pakistan, who is just across the border from Kandahar, which is the epicenter of the formation of the Taliban. And in fact, in the early 90s, when we lived there, although the Taliban name was not known internationally, the Taliban were essentially forming it at that time in the madrasas of Baluchistan and the Northwest Frontier Province. We lived for 8 years in Samarkand, Uzbekistan, returning from there in June of 2006 for me to take on the position that I presently hold at Yale. And really, one stream that has characterized our life and work all through, my wife and I have always been very involved in the local church wherever we find ourselves, and are just persuaded that connection with local church communities, which we've always had both in Pakistan, in Uzbekistan, and presently in New Haven, Connecticut, is absolutely essential in our life and work. The director of our program, Joseph Cumming, also spent much of his adult life working in the Muslim world. He and his wife, Michelle, and their two children lived in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania for approximately 15 years. We both have experienced some of the very things that Dr. Sukhdeo describes as characteristic in part of Muslim communities and Muslim textual traditions. We have experienced some of these things firsthand. And so I think that we've got some degree of street credibility in terms of the approach that we're taking. Just to comment briefly, I don't really want to expand much on the basic contours of the letter, the common word letter by 138 Muslim signatories. It clearly points out that while there are differences between Muslims and Christians, we can take as the starting point for future dialogue the basic foundations of love of the one God and love of neighbor. This letter was published at the end of Ramadan in October, and many saw it as one of the most significant interfaith documents since Nostra Aetate in 1965. Whether that's hyperbole or overstatement, I don't know, but it certainly is representative it's a very significant document that we do need to reckon with, regardless of our approach. Regarding the Yale response, and I prepared, in anticipation of some of the things that I thought Dr. Sukhdeo might raise, some of which he did actually raise, things that Dr. Sukhdeo had published in other places before, and some of which were slightly more developed and nuanced in his presentation today. So I'll only be able to superficially cover some of those things. Let me just say that in drafting the Yale response, which actually was drafted and posted on our website only days after the Muslim response, or the Muslim letter, but was received obviously much more airplay when it was published in the New York Times on November 13th. I mean, that kind of has a way of bumping things up to another level. But the letter was actually written sooner than that. The drafters and signatories really are not made up of what I would consider a naive group of Kumbaya Club type Christians, but really people that do have experience with the certainly less admirable dimensions of Islam and some of the concerns that Dr. Sukhdeo has raised. So it was not out of naivete that the letter was drafted. Certainly there was enthusiasm in the early days of drafting the Yale response at the opportunity afforded to engage in significant dialogue with a group of Muslims that we have not typically been able to engage in significant dialogue with. And we did not, and we were very much motivated by a desire not to lose a historic opportunity. Now, Dr. Sukhdeo raises the concerns that opportunity is one thing, preserving and standing for the truth is another. Now, I mean, I am no relativist, and the drafters of this letter are not relativists either. And it is the case that there are certain aspects of truth that we did not articulate in the Yale response. That is absolutely the case. But however, simply from a tactical standpoint, in rhetorically engaging with other communities, in dialogical engagement with other communities, it is not necessary in the first engagement to lay every article of truth on the table in the first conversation. We have been quite encouraged as we've been working with some of the Muslim signatories and drafters of the Common Word Letter at the openness to discuss precisely some of the key issues that Dr. Sokdeo raises, issues of religious freedom, issues of apostasy, which is a great embarrassment to more moderate Muslims, and is an issue which absolutely must be addressed in conversation. The question is not will we address them, but how we address them. And in fact, in the close of the Yale response, we say we are persuaded that a next step should be for our leaders at every level to meet together and begin the earnest work of determining how God would have us fulfill the requirement that we love God and one another. It is with humility and hope that we receive your generous letter, and we commit ourselves to labor together in heart, soul, mind, and strength for the objectives you so appropriately propose. So the assumption here is, yes, it is very possible that some or many of the Muslim signatories to the Common Word Letter and some or many of the Christian signatories to the Yale response have different things in mind when we talk about love of God and love of neighbor. The sheer diversity of signatories would almost guarantee this fact. But what is essential is that we actually sit down and are able to have conversations about precisely what those differences are. There is accountability on the part of the Muslim signatories to this letter by virtue of the very fact that they have publicly gone on record as saying, love of God and love of neighbor matters to us. Now, Dr. Sukdeo would read this as an instance of taqiyya, of Muslim dissimulation, of disingenuous deception in the interest of evangelizing people for the sake of Islam. It is certainly possibly the case. It is certainly possible that some of the signatories have this in mind, and that some may view the Common Word Letter as fundamentally a Muslim evangelistic document. As people who value and support the right of religious communities to seek to persuade one another to embrace other faiths, and who value religious freedom, if there are certain Muslim signatories that view this as an evangelistic document, that to me is not daunting at all. We would welcome that. We will sit down, I mean, certainly some of the Christian signatories would love to see many Muslims embrace Jesus Christ. Now, there are also Muslim signatories that are actually opposed to conversion in either direction, and there are certainly signatories on the Christian response that would be similarly opposed. There's a wide range of people on both sides. But the fact of the matter is that even if it is an evangelistic document, this should not daunt us and should not turn us away from dialogue. Just to close, I think my time is running short here. I want to stress that I do not want to minimize the very serious issues that we as Christians have with certain very real streams within the Muslim historical and textual tradition and cultural tradition. These things do not characterize all Muslims. It's not the only stream within the Muslim community. It's one stream within the Muslim community to which we must have our eyes open. That's a given. That is granted. But let us not see that as the only stream which we look at. Let not that be the only thing that we look at as we determine whether we engage or not. And in fact, should we, as serious followers of Jesus Christ, and I recognize that this is a diverse community here, many of whom may embrace other religious traditions or no religious tradition, but speaking as a serious follower of Christ, I have to view this as a starting point for dialogue, not an ending point, a starting point for dialogue. That this is the beginning of a long and detailed and difficult conversation that must exist between Muslim and Christian communities. In fact, what Senator Santorum said at the beginning of our session today, he mentioned that what Muslims said to him publicly and privately were very different. And I think that's actually an essential thing to recognize, is that the actual way in which we bring up truth, not just the fact that we do bring up truth, and I'm in complete agreement with Dr. Sukadeo that we do need to bring up truth, but the way in which we bring up truth can either set the course for constructive developments or less constructive developments. And we are absolutely persuaded that the truth must be spoken, but not necessarily laid on the table in its entirety in the first conversation. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. I wanted to give you both a chance to have a little bit of give and take before we open it up to questions and answers from the audience. So, please, what would it be okay if you stay seated here and then yes.
Fine. I think some very very quick responses. The why a public letter. Some of us have found this difficult to understand. You're right that the Muslim world needs to be engaged. The position His Holiness the Pope took was not to issue a public letter, such as you have done, but to write to the Muslims and says, look, let us meet, and here is the agenda. I see the need to do exactly what you're saying. I don't understand why you didn't take His Holiness's position, but rather issue a statement and call for signatories and put that in the public domain. The second is this. What you put into the public domain, did you consider the effects of that? At this moment in time in the UK and in Europe, not in the States where your churches are much stronger, we are faced in Great Britain with an Islamic Britain. This is not just me, Christians, but even government and other authorities are facing this. My wife has written a most remarkable book on why so many Christian women, evangelicals, are converting to Islam and marrying Muslims. Some of the key peoples are now converts. We now are in a position where the church is no longer sure of its faith. And your letter, actually by confusing those two issues by saying we both love God and love our neighbor, which is exactly the Muslim strategy in Europe, as well as in the Caribbean and elsewhere, where we see a massive move towards Islam, is actually increasing the confusion and playing into the Muslim hands at a time when Christians don't know. So your position has not led to clarity for Christians. And the third is this. In the back of my document response, you will see there a paper from the very institute that produced the 138. And note the date on this. This was at their conference on the Amman, 4th to 7th of September. And on page 32, this is what Dr. Hoffman says. He speaks of the difficulties confronting Islam. He says they include American evangelical Christians promoting a frightening politicized fundamentalism as well as what is called Islamism, i.e. a militant political ideology practiced by Muslims. The Institute recognizes that and now calls to say how are we going to interact with it and virtually counteract it, which is what their document is. And his document lays out clearly what the love of God and love of neighbor is. And I can't understand how Yale can build their case on what they believe might be the Muslim understanding when the pivotal document which shaped their view was already presented and whether this was seen. And I guess this is where my concerns really lie, because you have not only touched on theology or lack of theology, but you've moved into the realms of politics and you have addressed the U.S. geopolitical context, which is exactly where the Muslim wanted you to do.
Thank you, Dr. Sukhdeo. I left my pen up there, so I'm trying to remember what my...
And I'm using it.
No problem. So let's just briefly address Dr. Sukhdeo's final point first. We can take a textual approach to our understanding of Islam, whether historically or presently. We can also take a sociological and sociocultural approach to how we understand Islam, either historically or presently. And while it's certainly the case that some of the drafters and signatories to the Muslim letter have and will continue to go on record with certain understandings of what love and love of God and love of neighbor actually mean, it's mistaken for us to view those as completely static positions. The whole purpose for dialogue is that we actually have hope for change. So to say that, you know, there have been certain entrenched positions, therefore let us not engage on these things, is, I think, a mistake. Some people may not change. I'm no idealist. I mean, some people may persist in less than constructive perspectives, that's to be sure. But if we despair on the possibility of our Muslim neighbors and our Muslim enemies changing in any way, then we wouldn't engage in dialogue at all. So I think that's one thing. Regarding the issue you brought up of the difference between Christian communities in Europe and in Britain, particularly, and Christian communities in the United States, I think perhaps there is a sense that European Christian communities feel more under pressure or under siege from the increasing influence and presence of Muslim communities in their nations. That's certainly the case. This is a challenging reality, and we've seen a variety of reactions within Europe and within Britain, and sort of an ebb and flow of reactions to this changing reality. And it really stretches the flexibility of our pluralistic societies to have to deal with large Muslim communities that are wielding increasing influence in our pluralistic societies. What do we do with that? No easy answers on that account. Do I rejoice that many Christians are becoming Muslims? No, I don't necessarily rejoice in that. But we do, and we must, in whatever direction it might be, we must preserve and protect the right for freedom of religion, for people to convert one way or the other. And I don't even particularly like the word convert, but to change religions. And even on your own website, and after your response that you published at the end of November, I noted that the UN Declaration on Human Rights, the section on religious freedom, is cited. And we must preserve that. So there have to be ethical and appropriate responses to the realities that you represent here. There was one other thing that you mentioned in your remarks that I want to make sure I...
The political...
I didn't comment on that in our response. We have heard some concerns about the apology, perhaps more than anything else about the apology that we tendered. And it is the case that we could have perhaps nuanced the wording better than we did. The wording is as it is now, and it says what we want to say. It perhaps could have been better with a little bit more embellishment. Let me go on record as saying we absolutely do not want to equate the Christian faith with the U.S. government or any other government or political system in any kind of inextricable way. That is an absolutely wrongheaded and dangerous thing to do. So I'm in complete agreement with Dr. Sukhdeo on that account. In wording the apology the way that we did, we simply said, and we chose the words carefully and in very close consultation with a number of Christian leaders in this country and internationally, some of whom are resident as Christian minorities in Muslim countries. And what we said is that many Christians have been guilty of sinning. It doesn't say that the entire war on terror is a sin for which Christians are responsible. It doesn't say that the entire Crusades are a sin for which Christians are responsible. It says that many Christians have been guilty of sinning, both in the context of the Crusades and in the context of the modern war on terror. And I think that's a much less controversial statement if read in very precise terms. Now, I think Dr. Sukdeo may recognize a reality that we don't always read things in precise terms. And you have to deal with not only the denotative but the connotative meaning of what you say, and perhaps we could have taken more care on that account. But nonetheless, we are not in any way equating the politics with the faith tradition. So.
But you see, therein lies the dilemma. You have issued an open letter, which many have become signatories to, and which the Muslim world are responding to. So in a measure, you're going to be held accountable for what you have stated. Now, you may now wish to modify. You may give now a more nuanced meaning, but it is simply too late. I fully agree with you, the need to meet. I don't like to use the word dialogue. Mm-hmm. I have been in Jordan. I think this is, I ought to be nuanced in what I say. Mm-hmm. I have been involved in discussions with the most senior leaders of the House of Islam. In the UK, a meeting was held at Clarence House at our behest, chaired by the Prince of Wales, in which the senior Muslim leaders met with senior Christian leaders. And what we have sought is, behind closed doors, to carry on the kind of discussion that is necessary to seek to bring about change. So I fully agree with you that this is a process which we must engage in. But may I say, Yale's response was a public response, which locks all of us in to what is there. And given that so many Christian leaders have now signed it, this is putting pressure on some of the key leaders in the Muslim world, because there may be some of those who have agreed. I note the Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox churches have not signed. In the past weeks, I've been to Egypt and elsewhere with the most senior archbishops who are under substantial pressure, the Coptic Church. In Egypt, for example, yesterday I had lunch with one of the most senior members of Orthodoxy, looking at what is happening in Turkey and the Patriarch Bartholomew. So we have this huge dilemma to know, what are we going to do? And effectively, this Muslim letter, as I point out in my document here, has now divided evangelical Christianity. And a Christianity, not just in terms of evangelicalism, but in terms of a growing number of senior leaders in the Muslim world. And I speak of the Orthodox, I speak of Vatican itself, and the responses here in the US, principally by evangelicals.
There were a lot of noteworthy, I think one of the noteworthy facts about the Yale letter was that there were a lot of evangelical signatories. But I don't think that even a majority of the signatories are evangelicals. A substantial number are evangelical. Just a couple things. It is a public letter, and just let me say that I very much welcome and think it's very constructive to be having precisely the kinds of discussions that we're having right now. Now, this is not a distinctly Christian event, although I suspect that a number of people here are coming from a Christian perspective. These kinds of discussions are absolutely critical to be having. We will leaven one another's perspectives, and not only the what of our communication, but the how of our communication. I think that's essential. I do think that it's unfortunate to characterize the Yale response as divisive. I've actually been concerned with some of the words that you've used, Dr. Sukdeo, in recent weeks, involving some of the words like betrayal and appeasement, a sellout, naivete, gullibility. I think it's actually, I am very much in favor of vigorous disagreement. I'm very happy to do that. I grew up doing that at the dinner table. And but I think we need to be very careful not to to characterize, and others have even used words like apostate of the Christian signatories. I mean, you have not used that word. Others have used that word. And I think we need to be very careful not to inadvertently sow division by perhaps hyperbolically characterizing the response in ways like this. I just want to be careful on those accounts. Particularly, it definitely bumps up the adrenaline level of the discussion to bring in appeasement of Hitler into the equation. I think that's an overstatement, and that's the Holocaust is something that I would not want to compare much to, partly because I think it diminishes the significance of the Holocaust itself in so doing, and partly because we don't want to we want to be very careful in using that particular metaphor.
May I say, many of those words were used by Christian leaders in the Muslim world with reference to those who signed, and I think it's important to know how the non-Western church leaders feel, one, about the letter, and two, about those who responded, given they're principally North Americans. Secondly, with reference to the position in Germany, why there is a parallel, and I would point anyone here to the conflict between Bishop Bell and Bishop Headlam, and it arose out of Karl Barth and the Confessing Church over the position of Jewish Christian pastors and how the national Hitler had effectively brought into being the national church. Karl Barth and others took the decision they could only accept, and here they used a phrase, Jesus Christ is Lord. And if he is Lord, it meant that no other system could be put in place. This created major difficulties within Germany and in the UK, and it came to a head over Niemöller when he was arrested. Bishop Headlam, representing the then chairman of the International Affairs Office of the Church of England, strongly argued that they should have a policy of engagement with the National Church of Germany, even though it was linked to what Hitler wanted. The Times of England took that view, and the British government chamberlain took that view. The one dissenting voice was Bishop Bell, who argued passionately for the rights of minorities, and he elevated it to religious liberty. And this became the major problem. You may see all of that from the Holocaust, but before the Holocaust occurred, that issue had already arrived. And I have written much about the parallels that took place in Germany, 1934, 35, and 36, and what we now have in Europe, where for us, in the Barnabas Fund, to address the issues of persecution of Christians in the Muslim world, minorities, converts, the British media tell us we should stay silent. The British government tells us to stay silent, and all the major denominational leaders tell us to stay silent. There is a parallel, and it ended with the destruction of people. If we stand for liberty and freedom, we must do so in all accounts. I have been passionate, and if you read my works in 1970s and 80s, it was for the rights of Muslims, Hindus, and others. I have never changed. And what I expect or want for Muslims, I want for Christians. And at this point, any Christian group or body, as much as any Muslim group or body, if they deny those central principles and sacrifice them on the altar of interfaith dialogical relations, community relations, of social cohesion relations, must be addressed firmly from that position. There can be no compromise on central principles. Yes to dialogue, yes to your meeting, but once you enter into the public domain with those who would kill Christians, then we have to say, no, we will not accept it. And that is the principle on which I have lived my life, and on which our ministry is built.
Dr. Saperstein, before we take questions and answers, one final comment, and then we will open it up to the audience.
Thank you, and I appreciate your position, and I would in no way be saying stay quiet about that. I would not agree with those who would tell you to stay quiet. Absolutely, we must stand for persecuted Christians and people of any religious community around the world. We certainly have had friends, both Christian and Muslim, that have suffered at the hands of governments and much more informally in the countries in which we have lived and worked. So we're in complete sympathy with you on that account and in complete support of you on that account. I do think, while there may be some parallels, the Muslim world, 1.3 billion or whatever the numbers are these days, as a widely disparate community scattered all over the world, and pre-war Nazi Germany are not exactly the same thing. And at the same time, believe me, we do need to keep a check on our engagements and involvements so that we do not walk down the naive road of Chamberlain in the 30s. I'm persuaded that we're not doing that, or we would not be engaging on that level. I think just one final thing that I wanted to mention is that we can read Islamic texts, we can look at Islamic words, we can look at a variety of external realities, words, events, historical trends, etc. Coming from a Christian perspective, we want to take our fundamental and primary cues from our own textual and religious traditions. We want to certainly take into account the historical realities and the external words of others and the words of other textual traditions. But our first cues must be from our own textual traditions, not, as Dr. Sukdeo has recommended, not merely from the welling up of emotion in ourselves, not merely from our analysis of history or other textual traditions, but from the mandates of our own textual traditions. And I think that's something important to keep in mind as we consider the way forward in engagement.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we've got the mics ready. Okay, we're going to take questions, and I'd like you to state your name first and then pose the question, please. I think we are recording this. Are we recording this? So our plan is, and if you want anything off the record, you're going to have to let us know, because we're going to post this discussion and dialogue on a website. So you didn't know? Oh, you didn't know that? I told those guys up there. I told Gus it was on the record. Okay.
Sorry, I was just so excited. I actually had my hand up right before you finished, Stephen. Is it Dr. Salverstein?
Saperstein.
Saperstein. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. My question is for you. I'm going to try to, I hope I'm not too loud. I want to strike a middle ground between the urgency of the tone that you had for the second half of your speech, which was intense, and the much more gentle, maybe Anglo-Saxon way that we had from the other side of the aisle there. So I'll try to psych in between. I'm interested in your last comment. You urged us or exhorted us to seek our way forward from our own texts, for us to look to our textual traditions. And in those traditions, of course, we'll find such thoughts and topics as forgiveness and compassion, and I'm assuming that you wouldn't be urging us to look to, say some of the things in the Old Testament, which would say kill every one of them and their children and their oxen and et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure that you meant probably the nicer things. But nonetheless, I mean, text, we have lots in our text that we can do that for, and, judging from the tenor of your tone, I think you meant the nice ones. Would you say that what is good for the Christian goose is good for the Islamic gander? Would you urge them to look to their textual traditions for the way forward as well? Or would you not? That's my question, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, in a certain sense, you're asking me, and I've asked myself, if I were a serious Muslim, would I read the texts, the Muslim texts, the way that they are being represented in the Common Word Letter? And my answer to myself would probably be, well, probably not. I probably wouldn't read my texts in that way. At the same time, and I will continue on with the question that you asked me, I would definitely say, excuse me, I just lost my train of thought. I would not characterize Islam, if I were a Muslim, I would not characterize Islam probably the way it was characterized in the Common Word Letter. But given that a large number of Muslims have actually said that let's start talking on the basis of love of God and love of neighbor as a very legitimate starting point. Now, granted, there's significant debate as to the centrality of those two doctrines and the meaning of those two doctrines within our respective religious traditions, given that fact. Nonetheless, that, in our estimation, is an absolutely wonderful basis upon which to begin a conversation. It's a wonderful basis upon which to begin a conversation. In terms of your intuitions, obviously I didn't refer to any particular texts when I encouraged us to refer to our own textual traditions. Your intuitions are correct. I'm very much in favor of both emphasizing the wisdom and purity of heart, fear of God perhaps, that must characterize the way in which we move forward in any enterprise that has any significance like this. That is both the shrewdness and the innocence. We're to be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. Let's make sure both wings on the bird are flapping in the way in which we engage with other communities. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question or not, but.
Right here?
Yes.
The mic, please.
Thank you. I'm John Bradley. I'm a past national president of the Holy Name Society. One of my observations is that I certainly agree that as Christians we don't have any obligation to apologize for the war on terrorism, and I think some of the things that our government has done in the war on terrorism are the basis for which I would feel inclined to apologize as an American, but not specifically as a Christian. But one of my concerns about one of the consequences, which I did not foresee, and I don't think other people foresaw, of the war against Iraq as opposed to Afghanistan, was that it seems to me that Iraqi Christians are in much worse shape today than they were under the administration of Saddam Hussein, who A, had a Christian in his cabinet, B, did not persecute the Christian church, and perhaps just to get political support, I don't know, seem to treat Christians with considerable tolerance. And I'm much less convinced that a predominantly Shia Muslim government, even though democratic, will not persecute Iraqi Christians. So just want your comments on that. Did we do Iraqi Christians a disservice by waging that war?
Before I answer that, if I can be very brief about texts, I believe profoundly that we must love our enemies and embrace our enemies. But nowhere are we called to embrace the ideology of our enemies and to accept those ideologies. I think we must make a distinction between people and their ideologies. Secondly, in the discussion of religious liberty and how we respond to those who persecute, there is not one position. As you read the New Testament, you discover it is an unfolding position. For example, by the time we get to Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, who is the devil there? Most probably Nero, who is about to launch a genocide. By the time you get to the book of Revelation and John, persecution now becomes a reality. And what language does John use to describe persecutors? I just want you to suggest we need not just to have this static view of Scripture. We simply love, and it ends there. In fact, the progressive unfolding of Scripture becomes much, much more aggressive towards persecutors and uses language which perhaps we may not want to use. So I said that. With regards to your question, I first went into Iraq in 1998-99. I would say of Saddam Hussein, he persecuted everybody. He was a pretty evil man. But within that, because of the construct of the Baathist Party, which is based on secularism, nationalism, both in Iraq and in Syria, Christians had an important role to play because he could trust them more than either of the Shia and Sunni. And both in the political, as well as some of his most senior generals, actually his commander of the Republican Guards in the north was a Christian, General Paul. So Christians were there. My argument, my phraseology would be this. In Saddam's day, when I went in, you had stability and security, but no freedom. I could walk the streets, disappear at night, I never had to worry. I went back in after 2003, and I would argue there were degrees of stability, degrees of security, and degrees of freedom. Now, I've been back subsequently last year. I was the British military advisor in Basra, full battle armor and things like that, driving around with tanks. There is no, for Christians, there is no stability, no security, and no freedom. So the group who have lost more than anyone else, you're right, is the Christian community. I did last year, when I came back from my duty there, having met with the senior military leaders and came back here to Washington and met with the political leaders, exactly the same passion I show here, I showed there, and I stated that the Christian community is facing an impending genocide. Will the U.S. act? Again and again, I'm told that the U.S. will not act to protect Christian minorities. I've been to Syria recently. We have now more than 400,000 Christian refugees in Syria. Places like Qamishli, Hasakah, Aleppo, the outskirts of Damascus, living in abject poverty. They have lost everything. No one will come to their aid. U.S. aid will give something. UN will not really become deployed. In Basra, there are 3,000 Christians left. The mighty church is virtually gone. All the way up to Baghdad, Dika, they've all gone. Amba, all Christians have gone. Dora, over 60% of Christians have fled. Over Christmas, the Eastern Christmas, which was just 2 weeks ago, 7 or 8 churches bombed, nothing in the press. Mosul is now under attack. That's where Christians have fled. So the position of Christian minorities is most acute. And may I say where it deals with this subject is why are Christians being depopulated? The whole of southern Iraq, where the Shia are in control, particularly Muqtada, Islamic law is in place. Women, if they do not wear hijab, are being systematically killed. In Dora, we had the old injunction of Islamic Sharia. What did it say? If you do not convert to Islam or pay jizya, we will kill you. The only option is to flee. This was known to the American and British authorities. The Muslim governments know this. No one has taken a stance. And the frustration which we have and Iraqi Christians have, and why, may I say, those who in Syria and others are so upset with this letter, is they're saying, well, who will come to our aid? Islam is now reaching out to destroy the church in the Middle East. And I point you to the Middle East, to the websites on the Middle East. Many Islamic websites are now saying it's time for the church finally to be removed, her presence from the Middle East.
Daryl? Okay.
Thank you. My name is A.J. Nolte, Catholic University. I actually have two questions for Dr. Saperstein, both involving the somewhat controversial war on terror apology. One a political question and one a theological question. My political question is, was there concern, was there thought given to the fact that this Christian response might endanger Christian communities in Muslim countries? I say this because there is a tendency, particularly, and I'm sure you're aware of this, in radical Islamist discourse to link local Christians to the United States, the Crusades, sometimes Israel, sometimes going to ridiculous lengths to do that. I remember an instance where Chinese Catholic businessmen were linked to Zionism in Indonesia. So if they're willing to go to this somewhat ludicrous length, does the fact that a Christian letter, even if intended well and in good faith, makes a reference to this war on terror, does that not give a pretext for Islamists in these various countries to make a linkage between their local Christian communities and the war on terror? My question from a theological perspective is, why begin with an apology? It seems to me that the Muslims began with placing love of God and love of neighbor in the context of oneness. Why not, as Christians, begin by placing love of God and love of neighbor within the context of our concept of God, which is incarnational and relational?
Those are good questions. In answer to your first question regarding whether we consulted with and considered the impact of this letter on Christian communities in Muslim nations, the answer is yes. We had significant input in early stages from Christians in Lebanon, Christians in Kuwait. The Bishop of Kuwait, Camilo Balin, signed. Riyad Qassis in Lebanon was also closely involved. Is it the case that certain Muslim groups might use this letter as a pretext for action against Christians? That's possibly the case. But those who want to take violent action against Christians are simply looking for pretexts. And so, I mean, pretexts will be found for those who want to do that. We did consider these things. Why begin with an apology? And again, this has been among the most controversial parts of the letter. A unique characteristic of Christians is that they're quicker to apologize than to condemn. At least in theory, that's a unique characteristic of Christians. It seems that the biblical record would require us to be quicker to take responsibility for our own wrongdoings than we are to point out the wrongdoings of others. That doesn't say that we don't point out the wrongdoings of others, particularly after we have already taken responsibility for our own. Many people have asked, you know, why are you doing this? Muslims aren't apologizing. And it's like, well, you know, I have an argument with my wife at home. It ends a lot quicker if I apologize for what I'm responsible for much more quickly. And I think the same thing holds true if you expand, you know, you expand the number of interlocutors by a millionfold. So I don't think it's tactically wrong or theologically wrong to apologize at the outset of the letter. In fact, I think it sets the stage for actually giving us more moral authority to speak into the very issues that Dr. Sukdeo and others have raised. The fact that we've apologized gives us more moral authority, not less.
Dr. Sukdeo, could you speak a little bit more to the timing of the original Muslim document and what significance you may see as to their issuing this statement at this particular time, given what's going on in the Muslim world?
Looking at the global scene as to where Islam is currently positioned and where the West is currently positioned, post 9/11, we have had Iraq, Afghanistan, and of course, with the rapidity of terrorist acts across the world, a response coming, not just, may I say, from the West, i.e. the US, but India, many other countries are now having to respond to this. Central to this, to these acts, is actually now theology and understanding. Where is violence located in the Islamic tradition? Is it an aberration or is it central? What the Muslim world and their senior leaders are having to grapple with is this. If they accept the premise that violence is located in their texts, in classical Islam, in their legal formulations, how might this affect their dawah activities? Might people respond, etc., etc.? So they have created now a massive machinery effectively to propagate Islam is peace. Islam and Christianity shares the same values, spiritual, moral, and ethical. The moves increasingly, and literally billions of dollars are being spent on this around the world, is to reshape the environment. For example, in Berlin, 2 years ago, which has now been accepted by the European Union, a redefinition of all terminology. It's the new lexicon. Pentagon is taking it on, the US military, the US government. And all of it is effectively to work on the premise of what is known as the Abrahamic faiths, that Jews, Christians, and Muslims have the same fundamental beliefs and ethics. The God is the same, and the outworkings are the same. And that if we therefore embrace this commonality of the Abrahamic faiths, then we will be able to progress. The question is it true? Secondly, if it is not true, particularly in the context of, say, faith, where do we locate the understanding of God? Is the Muslim understanding of God the same as the Christian? Are the ethical values the same? So I see this letter, and I spend my life reading primary Islamic texts, both in my research work in academia, military, and others, and for the Barnabas Fund, as a part of this whole movement.
One more. Daryl here.
Thank you. Daryl Charles, James Madison Program. Just a caveat, I guess. You would not print the apology to your wife in the New York Times if it was that important, if you were concerned about truth. You would not use such a high level of visibility. In addition to speaking publicly for the Christian world, which Yale does not, in spite of the hundreds, literally hundreds of names that at least today are attached to the document, and in addition to making a political statement about forgiveness, which is a policy decision, and therein perhaps the Catholic Catechism can help us. And it's notable that most of the signees were in fact Protestants. That says a lot about our theological vacuity. But we do not speak for those, and we even make it harder for those trying to wrestle with policy implications by making public statements that are theologically deficient. What is most troubling, I guess, about both the common word as well as the response was the fact that it really didn't deal with our theological differences. As Dr. Sukdo indicated earlier, the response was basically, we agree. We agree. There's no gentle taking to task or nuancing or modification of any of the statements. And so therefore, issues that were brought up before, such as Trinitarian theism or Christology or incarnation, render the document not just needing nuance, but false. It's not true. We do not worship, as the call asks us to do, we do not worship the same deity. And we do not have common ground. After reading both documents and reading Common Word again, I realized the texts that were marshaled by the 138 do not match. They do not say the same things. And it strikes me as remarkable that the Christian signees in response did not at least note that. And as the distinction was already made, it's one thing to desire to enter dialogue, and perhaps the Catholic Church has set a model there for us. It's another thing to try to represent the Christian world and speak to the authorities, making historical and less than theologically nuanced statements. Seems to me that some of the signatories should have been among the martyrs or the persecuted in the church. But no, these were for the most part Western theologians. And it seems to me those who are part of the suffering church would serve as proof of the pudding in terms of the validity and deficiency of this statement.
Well, I'm sure there's a question in there somewhere, but
no question intended. That was intended to be okay. A multitude of comments.
Okay. Okay. We are at. We got two more minutes. I'll tell you what. This fellow back here has been trying to get my eye for a while. Yeah. I'm sure everybody else is. I apologize. We're running out of time here, but one more.
Thank you. I'm Reverend Michael Hahn from Clifton, New Jersey. And I've been dealing with Islam since 1967 when people came into my workplace and told me they're going to take over the United States. And they're working their way to do this. Now, I want them to listen to what I said. They get answer to what I got to say, okay?
Just try to form a question rather quickly because we are running out of time here.
Okay. Our heritage in Christianity is totally different than Muslim heritage. They are under the law. We are under grace. There's two different things. Grace is something that Jesus did for us. Under the law, you can't get to heaven. No one can get to heaven by doing fulfilling the law. Only Jesus could do that. So therefore, we have to get to their culture. They have a law that says there is no Son of God. And that's why you got wars in Christianity. My question is, why don't you get into the ethics of Christianity? In other words, you got to deal with this on the issue of religion.
I certainly agree that we need to deal with this on the basis of religious discussion, absolutely. And I think that's one of the realities that's being increasingly recognized by governments around the world is that if we are on a political level to bring constructive engagement between Muslim and Christian and Jewish communities, we must of necessity address religious questions, which secular governments are ill-equipped to do. And I think that's one of the crises that we're facing right now, which is why people like Dr. Sukdeo are being brought into to government situations to comment on religious matters. So that's absolutely the case. And as I'm hearing this, and just to reply to the comments, not the question that my friend over here brought up also, there's, I think, to some extent, I mean, we are absolutely committed to absolute truth. The form of rhetorical approaches, the way we approach that, the way in which we reveal the truth, and Dr. Sukdeo has discussed the fact that it's often progressive, and we are advocating for precisely that, not the hiding of the truth, but the speaking of the truth in the context that it needs to be spoken.
This has got to be the last one. It's probably appropriate that it is from
thanks for the grace of a last question. This is a bit of a corollary to what AJ said. My question is about the apology, not starting with an apology itself, but the substance of what you're apologizing for. So I am wondering how you chose what to apologize for, which I think is where the controversy is.
Right. What we chose were simply two of the most available and salient concerns within the Muslim world as regard offenses by Christians and others to the Muslim world. So those are just salient examples in the minds of most Muslims today.
I wonder if I may just add a thought here. You used the analogy earlier of you quarreling with your wife. I want you to imagine you're not just quarreling with your wife, but you're a wife beater. You beat her up mercilessly, and she reaches the point where she has hit you back. You now then say to her, you must apologize, wife, and then you must publish that apology in the public press, in other words, to humiliate her. Now, you have used crusades in a very generic way. The first crusade needs to be separated from the remaining six, that there were these seven major crusades and a number of minor ones. Those who that whilst there may have been justification, I, for one, am not so ready to dismiss the First Crusade. It was as a response to what was happening to Christian minorities in the Holy Land, the Middle East, the Mediterranean basin under Muslim corsair pirates. Rome itself threatened that brought about a response. You're correct. Subsequent crusades were disastrous for Oriental Christians, particularly the Fourth Crusade, the Jewish community, Muslims, and everyone. Now, it would have been important to have mentioned that from 632 to around about 1094 and a bit later, Islamic Jihad had virtually taken over those whole areas. You said you were from Pakistan. My origins were Pakistan. In the second century, Pakistan, or that region, was Christian. Afghanistan was Christian. Islam wiped it out, and then later with the Mongols. The church was systematically wiped out. Why no reference to that? The war on terror. We may say the West, all right, has engaged now to fight terrorism. But may I say it was Bin Laden that attacked America, not America, that first attacked the Muslim world. And if we are going to see it in a Muslim perspective, can you imagine what would have happened had an American Christian blown up the mosque in Mecca? The whole of the Muslim world would have gone up in smoke. They would have been attacking everybody else. We need, therefore, to begin to unravel what exactly do we mean when we say we're going to apologize for the war on terror. And if, as you rightly say, there may be aspects which were not conducted correctly, may I say, if you look at the acts of Islamic violence today against each other and against Christian minorities, how many mosques are being destroyed by Christians around the world? How many Muslims are being killed? I can begin to tell you of the numbers of churches, Christians being massacred with no response. And herein lies the dilemma of the apology. It is out of all proportion. It does not address the issues. But more than that, you stigmatize now all the rest of us, people like me, now with that label. And I will have to carry your apology. Your apology for what? What do we say to Christians in northern Nigeria, Sulawesi, Ambon, Iraq, Turkey? I can go on endlessly. How is your apology going to help them? And furthermore, in what is going to be a protracted war, and maybe I speak as an analyst, which is going to last for decades, how are we going to address now our own nation and a military to defend itself against radical Islamic movements, and if need be, to take that work for further? Are you saying that the Christian church, the evangelical movement, will effectively now lay down its duties as a citizen? I'm not talking about Christians, as a citizen, and say we will not pursue the legitimacy of self-defense to protect our own interests, because that is where your apology is actually leading you.
Final comment,
please. Yeah, obviously. The apology doesn't say what Dr. Sukdeo just characterized. It's very specifically chosen words that say something very specific, that many Christians have been guilty of sinning against Muslims, both in the past, i.e. the Crusades, and in the present, e.g. in excesses of the War on Terror. It neither makes a blanket apology for the entire Crusades, nor makes a blanket apology for the entire War on Terror. It very specifically apologizes and says that many Christians have sinned against Muslims in these things. And so let's be careful not to read more. I mean, I'm also beginning to think that this Yale response is a lot weightier document than we imagined. I really don't think that it is saying the things that it's being characterized to have said on this account.
Okay, thank you. Just a brief publicity announcement. On 29 February, we're going to have George Weigel and Phil Jenkins, who's a scholar from Penn State University, well known, will be discussing the rise of Islam in Europe. And that's on February 29th, just a verbal heads up for that event. And on the issue of Abrahamic faiths and commonality, you might want to take a look at George Weigel's new book, which I think we may have out there on faith and reason. What exactly the title is? Faith, Reason, and the War on Jihadism, in which he discusses precisely this point. Once again, thank you very much.